DrunkenDumplingChico.com. Drunken Dumpling is where they love food, flavor, and our community. And I want to thank our third sponsor, D.A. Lampe Construction, a proud supporter of KZFR Community Radio in Northern California. For more information, visit DALampeConstruction.com. So, as you know, Ask Dr. Gale is on the second Thursday of every month from 6 to 7 p.m., and I interview really interesting people from around the world. Today, we're going to hear from Vanessa Avery, and she's a professor at Chico State and at Yale Divinity. So, obviously, she does some online teaching. And she's director of a place called Sharing Sacred Spaces, and she's involved with interfaith engagement at Yale Divinity School, and her focus is on interreligious engagement. So we're going to hear from her for a minute. But right now I'm thinking about gender because I'm just finishing up a book called A Global Dialogue on Masculinity. And what I'm finding is that young men are feeling all the talk about toxic masculinity. It's making them feel unwelcome and put down. And it could be part of the reason that college students in the U.S. are 60% female. So Megan is a college student as well as being our good staff person at KZFR. So Megan, what do you observe? I know there's more women at Chico State than men. What are you seeing in terms of why there might be 60% female students? And it's a phenomenon around the world, except in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, I know my brother, he went to Chico State, and he would talk about how when he would have to take the online courses, he felt really like in trouble as a man, based on what other men have done, you know, based on sexual assault cases and things like that. And, you know, he never would think about that. But because he had to take them, and it felt like he was in trouble because, and he couldn't have like an open relationship at school because men were looked at as dangerous. And so that's kind of what he perceived.
Wow. What about In secondary school, I interviewed, all these interviews are on my YouTube channel, so you can see their faces. I interviewed a young woman named Andy, A-N-D-I, in New York City. Mm-hmm. And she said when she was growing up, the teachers obviously thought of the boys as troublemakers and the girls as the good students. Mm-hmm. And her friends and her would say, I hate boys, except if they had a boyfriend. Does any of that resonate with you?
Oh, totally.
Really?
I agree. I think my teachers would kind of treat the boys as like rowdier and kind of let them goof off and or expect them to. And so I think that is what kind of caused it for our classes. And I remember I even got asked by a teacher to like help these boys in class, and I'm like, that's weird. You know, they're just students.
What
you know?
Grade was that?
That was fifth grade. I was asked to like peer over these boys and help them be less troublemakers in class, and I'd have to help them with their homework, and they could totally do it. It just, the teacher, I think you're right, it is kind of a put down, like, oh, you need help from a girl or from someone who's studious and knows how to have it all together at school.
Wow. I know when I first graduated from Berkeley, I taught junior high, which is the hardest thing I've ever done.
Oh, wow, yeah.
But I would definitely do that. You know, put a girl by a boy, divide up groups of girls who are talking or boys who are throwing paper airplanes or whatever it is. But something major is happening. Warren Farrell wrote a book called The Boy Crisis, where he talks about boys and men are more likely to commit suicide.
Yeah.
Their mental health problems don't express the same way that girls do. Like, depressed men can be angry or turn to drugs and alcohol so they don't get treated.
Bottled up. Of how men are supposed to act. And that is the toxic masculinity of you can't feel those emotions. You know, you need to be strong in all of this. And women are allowed to express all of their feelings all the time. It's expected that women are supposed to be way more and overly emotional, which can be the stereotype. And then for men, it's completely the opposite. So there's no balance there.
What do you find in your day-to-day classes? Who talks? Who monologues? Who interrupts? Who answers questions? Deborah Tannen wrote a lot about speech patterns of men and women being mm-hmm. different. And I wondered what you see just in your daily yeah. observations.
Yeah, when I had an English literature class, it was the literature of the child. More women definitely spoke up, for sure, and they would talk more. They felt more comfortable, and the men in the class didn't. They were definitely outnumbered by the women. But when I'm coming into recording arts classes, it's always the opposite because it's a male-dominated field. So it's like I'm the only girl, so they're all men, so I feel less confident. But I still talk, and I've learned to over the years. But in the other classes, in general education, it's definitely women are dominating the classes and answering more questions.
So what you're saying is in areas where there's more of one gender than they dominate, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah, like kind of cliquey behavior, even if you're not thinking about it or seeing it that way.
You know, it really surprised me. Again, the name of the book is A Dialogue on Global Masculinity, and I interview men from 12 countries, different ages, ethnicities. If anybody wants to read a chapter or two, they could email me at gkimball@csuchico.edu. And I was surprised even in the Netherlands, which I think of the Nordic countries and Denmark, Scandinavia, as being really egalitarian. But the young man who is 32 from the Netherlands named Stefan, he said that when he was growing up, not that long ago, people thought he was gay because he wasn't as assertive. He liked ballroom dancing. He didn't happen to be. But I was surprised that even in Nordic countries, there's can be kind of shaming and this view
just
of
for those feminine aspects, or if it seems more feminine, it's not acceptable for a man to partake in those activities. But for women, it's really the opposite. They've really worked hard, I think, to try to fight that narrative. And for women, they're like, oh, well, I can do any job, you know, that a man can do, and that's completely acceptable. But now on the other hand, you know, why are people getting shamed for wanting to do ballroom dancing in school? And I knew so many kids that loved, you know, music and theater and all of that, and they were presumed to be, you know, not like everyone else, and they were called gay. And it's not a bad word anymore, but it still is something you shouldn't throw around as a derogatory term at someone. It's sad that men don't feel like they can express their passions.
Another thing that surprised me is I interviewed a young man named Tristan in his early 20s in North Carolina, and he said men and women hook up, you know, they have relationships, but he feels like on some level they don't really like each other. I thought, wow, that's amazing. Do you ever have any sense of that?
You know, I can see that for sure, but I think that I have a lot of friends of both genders, so when it comes to more of a friendship, I think, yes, that happens, but when it comes to romance, I think our generation, this is just from what I've perceived, it's very stone cold, and it's that Tindery kind of 15 seconds swipe right, swipe left kind of behavior. And if you're not in that dating app field, dating can feel so weird because you don't know like who's on Tinder, and they're all doing their Tinder thing, which I've heard a lot of people do, and I sometimes feel out of the game.
It's like
a hookup-y site. So it's like you feel out of the game because all of your other peers are kind of doing this online thing, which can make it a stone cold, you know, you don't know anything about that person, so then you might not like them, but you're just kind of using each other, and that can be the point for most people now, is just they just want to use people.
I'm starting, of course, on a new book, and it's about young feminists around the world, and so far I've interviewed a woman in Turkey, New York, other places, and they said they didn't really want to get married.
Yeah.
It wasn't a goal for them. If it comes along, you know, maybe, but it's not like my goal in life is to get an MRS degree.
That is starting to happen. I know my friends, a lot of them really career oriented. My best friend, she's, you know, very traditional. So she, of course, wants to get married. But for the most part, I see my friends that I don't want kids. I don't want to get married. I don't want to do that. And it's interesting that that's diminishing with this generation.
What do they say as to why? Why don't they want kids or a
spouse?
My friend says she doesn't want to have kids. She doesn't want to bring kids into this world where it's so complicated, especially if things just don't start getting better with the virus and
climate change.
Climate change for sure. So there's a lot of worries on people that they don't want to bring kids, especially if they feel like their life has been really affected by these big aspects like climate change, then they don't want to have their kid have it worse.
Another thing that really surprises me is my grandson is just turned 11, and his age group are saying, I'm non-binary.
Yeah.
I'm demi-girl.
Mm-hmm.
And even at 11, they're not even, you know, adolescents. They're thinking in terms of gender fluidity. What's that all about?
Yeah, you know, I've seen a lot on the TikTok age of kids really just expressing it, and they're going totally against those gender normative ideas. I think it has to do with people like, you know, I know Harry Styles is a big icon for wearing skirts and men. And
Is he an actor?
He's a singer. He's in a band. But it all started with David Bowie. I mean, he was the one who really started the movement of men can wear feminine things and they
makeup,
don't have to, yeah,
jewelry,
be on one thing, and women can do it too, or women can be more masculine. And I find it interesting. I mean, I wasn't a part of that generation, but I think it's really important that people feel able to express themselves however they see themselves. I don't know if gender is as important as it used to be.
Obviously, it's not.
Yeah.
I asked my grandson what his pronouns were,
yeah,
and he goes, dragon.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome.
I said, well, aren't there male and female dragons?
Just dragon.
Just dragon.
Hey, dragon. What's up? That's awesome. That's super cute.
Yeah. So when you're at school, at university,
yeah,
are people hanging out, like, for lunch with mixed sex? Do we even say that word? Mixed,
yeah,
gendered people? Or what is it, like, there's these men's groups and women's,
yeah,
groups, and they don't talk except to have sex once in a while?
Well, it depends where you are on campus. Like, I'm in the music group, and I mean, I do recording arts, so it's all those kids. They're kind of a mosh pit of anything, and they all hang out, and it doesn't really matter. But I see, you know, sorority packs. It kind of does run in, like, the sorority women versus the frat guys. They come together sometimes and throw their big shebangs, but it seems like more of a game or a social, just, you know, something to do on the weekends. So I don't think, you know, they might not like each other. I don't know. I've never been involved in one of those situations, but I can see how they might not like each other, but they just hang out because they have something in common where they're in a specific group.
I was in Tridel sorority for a couple of years at Berkeley, and the big focus was to not be in the sorority house on Saturday night.
Yeah.
Or if you were, you hid.
Yeah. You're like, I'm not here.
I'm on a great date somewhere.
Yes,
so there's
totally
a lot of emphasis on dating, just but and that may be still true for Greek,
yeah,
organizations now.
I'm not sure. I have a few friends in it, but yeah, you know.
But what I am hopeful about is young people like the pre-adolescents that I know, they don't care what color your skin are.
Oh,
they,
yeah,
don't care if your hair is green or blue.
Oh, they are so, like, my mom, she's a fifth grade or third grade teacher. And even at that age, like, they are just expressing, you know, they don't care. They just want to see you for who you are. And my mom works a lot with just trying to get these kids to be grateful and express gratitude for everyone. And I think even at that age, like, we're starting to see a wave of kids that are just so much more accepting for different types of people. And I think that's been a big push for the past few years, is from people who were different, they wanted to be accepted and had people who are weird let, you know, do whatever they want. And so now it's the new normal.
Yes.
Because anyone's allowed to express whatever.
Right. Well, you know what I always think about, though, is we're in California and we're different.
We are.
So I have a friend of mine who used to teach with me at Chico State who moved to Louisiana.
Mm.
And it's totally different. You know, her friends who are educated send her racist jokes online and made fun of Obama. And, you know, and they think mask wearing is, I don't know, effeminate or something.
Yeah.
So I don't...
We are in a pretty liberal area, especially, you know, California. So I haven't traveled. I mean, my brother lives in Kentucky now, and it's definitely different there.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a lot more of a different mentality, for sure, an older one.
Right. So overall, are you kind of hopeful, or are you pessimistic in terms of the men and women getting along?
Yeah, I think that we'll have to take our time with it, because there is a big wave of this new non-binary thing coming in, and a lot of people are really stone in their old ways of only two genders, and it'll take some time, and I think that people are angry about it. I'm not. I love it. I think it's great and awesome, and it inspires me. So I am hopeful, but other people might see it as a bad thing, and they would be really pessimistic about
that. So you're hopeful because there's more freedom.
Oh, for sure.
We're not so in our, they call it the man box, where you can't cry or express vulnerability or whatever. Anything else you want to add before we talk to Vanessa?
No, I just think that it's important to accept all people, and, you know, sometimes keep your opinions to yourself. You want to make sure you want to know who you're talking to when you're expressing your opinions, and be educated about it. So that's all I have to say.
Megan Hammer, thank you for talking
with us. Yes, thank you for having me.
Oh, every time. So will you cue in
course.
Vanessa? So if you're just joining us, we're listening to Vanessa Avery, and she's a professor in the Religious Studies Department at Chico State and at Yale Divinity. And she is interested in interfaith and sacred space work. So let's see what's on her mind.
A neighborhood called Jamaica Estates. Some people call it Hollis. And I grew up in a house with my extended family. There were eight of us. And my grandparents lived there, their kids, my great-grandfather lived there, so there was a lot of people always to play with. It was a great home. The other thing when I talk about where I was born, I always remember that my elementary school was right across the street, and I used to come home for lunch every day and eat with my grandmother. And that's about it. I mean, I remember going back a few years ago, actually, to look at the house where I grew up, and maybe things seem so much bigger when you're a small person and you're very young, but the house, I always thought it was this mansion, you know, with endless rooms, and I went back and I looked at it, and it was this very modest, small house.
How many bedrooms
house.
Were there?
Oh, gosh. Well, we had eight people, so we had three bedrooms on the first floor. We had two bedrooms on the second floor.
Oh.
And then there was a bedroom they created in the basement for their oldest son. So it seemed like a big house.
Well, that's
maybe just not that much square footage.
Yeah, that's a lot of bedrooms. What month were you born, and year, if you don't mind saying? I'm interested in your astrological sign.
Oh, interesting. I was born February 22nd, 1970.
So is that Pisces?
It is. On the cusp of Aquarius, but it's Pisces, yeah.
And do you feel like a sensitive, sometimes can't make up my mind between two directions person or not?
I would say that making decisions is something that I have worked on for many years of my life. Yes. And it's still something I work on. But I don't think it's, you know, so much my nature as I think I'm just careful. You know, I want to research things. Part of, I guess, my training as a scholar is I do research things a lot. So I just want to have all the information. I'm very analytical before I make a decision.
Can't fault that. When you were growing up, was your family observant in terms of their religious practices?
They were. Yeah, my home was Jewish conservative.
Oh.
Which means, you know, for anyone on listening to the show who doesn't know the Jewish branches, so in like the modern state of the world, Judaism has three main branches. There are more, but three main ones. Reform, which is more
liberal,
less observant on rituals, but more focused on social ethics and action. Orthodox, which is more focused on maintaining all the rituals, also focused on social ethics and action, but I would say putting emphasis on observing in the same tradition. And then conservative falls somewhere in the middle. So that's where we were. So we were kosher, and we went to shul on the high holidays, and we did observe the Sabbath, but not fully. So I grew up conservative.
And did observing the Sabbath mean that you didn't do work or electronic devices, that kind of thing?
Yeah, good question. It meant, sorry, I wish my phone didn't throw my computer off. I'm back. Sorry about that. So we started the Shabbat Friday night with a special meal and blessings over bread and wine. And then my grandfather owned a store where he would close the store for the Sabbath, but he was open on Sunday, so he was open 6 days a week, but not on the Sabbath, so no, we didn't work. We did cook, and we did turn on lights. We didn't, you know, observe it that strictly, but it was certainly a special day where we didn't partake of our regular business.
Yeah, but before we leave Judaism, I've been thinking about initiation rituals and how in broader, I guess you could say, Western culture, what is it to become an adult? You have sex, you get a driver's license, you get drunk when you're a fresh person in college. I don't know. But having bar mitzvah or bas mitzvah, did that serve to make you feel like you had some guidance into becoming an adult?
That's so funny you say that. My mother was bas mitzvahed, and that was back in the 60s. But after my mom, my grandparents had, you know, my mom had a younger sister who did not get bas mitzvahed, but had a sweet 16. And then when I came along, I was given a choice between being bas mitzvahed and having a sweet 16. And at that age, I have to say, I chose the sweet 16 because it seemed a whole lot more fun and attractive.
Does it just mean a big party with fancy dresses?
Party.
It's like a quinceanera.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess that was the ritual for becoming an adult three years later than the bas mitzvah would have been. But I chose to do that instead of going to Hebrew school. And, you know, so that's something still on my bucket list. I haven't been bas mitzvahed. And so I do think it's important to have that kind of structure, and it gives you a sense of responsibility at a young age to understand that you do have a purpose and you do have a contribution, and there is something that, there is a structure to follow and a sense of, yourself as a meaningful entity in this world, you know, for lack of any other way of putting it to me.
This is really a different facet, but I've been reading about epigenetics and how our environmental stressors or circumstances can be passed on to our ancestors, our descendants. And the example that people give most often is Holocaust survivors, that their descendants tend to be more fearful, anxious. Do you find that true just anecdotally in terms of what you've seen? Is that a fair analysis?
That's interesting. I mean, I agree with you, and I've always understood it in a language of, it's more of a Buddhist language, I guess, of habit energies. So habit energies get passed from parents to their children, and that could be fear and as well as courage and sadness or things like that. My grandparents were not Holocaust survivors. They actually, their parents got out earlier around the turn of the century. So around 1900 was when they started coming over to the country. So I didn't personally have that experience. Maybe the Great Depression might have been something that affected me more, where, you know, it's funny. I remember my grandparents, we always had an abundant amount of food, but we always had to finish everything on our plate. And then we were offered seconds, as if the world was going to completely run out of food. We had to fill up. And also money. We did have plenty of money, you know, thankfully from the business. But it was never that we were extravagant. We had to save our money and never spend lavishly on clothes or food or anything like that. There were more important things that we needed money for. So I think maybe that event in history definitely affected how I was raised, and I'm very much the same way. I'm very prudent with money. I don't like to waste food, but I see other families who always leave a piece of food on their plate. And I'm still thinking, well, I know there's a meaning behind that too, and it definitely comes from their parents, but it's a very, we could never leave that on our plate. Mm. It was too much of a scarcity, understanding of scarcity, I think. Mm. So yeah, I agree with that. It's interesting. In terms of the Holocaust, I can't say personally, but certainly I think there's a sensitivity in my world as a Jewish person to any kinds of marks of anti-Semitism and how these things can spiral out of control. They really can, because it's still very much in our culture. It always has been for thousands of years. So that's certainly a sensitivity that's always been there, and that certainly, I think, the Holocaust was just a culmination of so many years of pogroms and other anti-Semitic behaviors. It's hard to say it was just that, but it's always there, a sensitivity, I would say.
How does that tie into the fact that in all my studies, Jews are overrepresented in terms of being innovators, thinkers? I did a trilogy on visionary scientists, and way more were Jewish than are the 2% or whatever of the world that's Jewish, whatever it is. And, you know, Einstein and Marx and Freud, and, you know, you could go on and on in terms of influential thinkers who are Jewish. What's the correspondence between being on the outskirts and being innovators and brilliant thinkers?
You know, that's such a good question. I do know there are so many brilliant Jewish innovators. I know there are Jewish, not just Jewish innovators. So they are in every religious tradition. You have innovators, but being on the outskirts, I think, you know, the Jewish people have had to figure it out to survive over a long, long history. And so I think that's one aspect of that we have to come up with creative ways of surviving in society that doesn't necessarily want us here. And I say that now, of course, our society here has been amazing, but historically speaking. And so that's part of it. Innovation, I think, had to be there. How do we observe our religion as well when the world observes differently? That needs innovation too. Mm. So we might close on Saturday, but the world closes on Sunday. So there's a way that we need to, I think that is differently. I think also education, you know, when the Second Temple was destroyed in 70, long time ago, you know, something had to replace it, and really what replaced it was study of Torah and study of the scriptures. So study is also built in to the tradition very, very strongly. So we don't go to the temple and make sacrifices anymore. We study, and that takes the place of it for blessings. And so I think maybe the combination of all of that has created some really incredible insights.
Let's go back to your younger years, and what led you to get a PhD? Why did you decide to do that rather than be a business person or something like your grandfather?
I still like being a business person. I run a nonprofit now, and actually I find myself very fulfilled in doing that. But I did I did want to get a PhD. I guess I was always compelled to study myself. I did comparative religion for my undergraduate degree back at McGill University.
We're listening to Vanessa Avery, who is a professor at Chico State and Yale Divinity School, talking about interreligious kind of traditions. So again, email me, gkimble@csuchico.edu. Listen the second Thursday of every month. And also, we do free energy balancing every Wednesday for Shalom Free Clinic, 1010 Mangrove. Every Wednesday from 5 to 7 p.m., drop in. So let's get back to Vanessa Avery.
And then I decided I wanted to do a PhD at that point, but I had a very, very highly specialized degree in Hebrew Bible from London. So I actually applied and went to Yale Divinity School to broaden my base for the PhD. And then after that, I didn't apply directly, which was interesting. I decided to go back into the workforce. So I again moved back to New York. So I hope this story is not getting too long.
No, it's great.
But that's when I sat down with myself and I said, I have 3 degrees in religious studies. If I don't do a PhD, what on earth am I going to do? Because you can't get a faculty position, really, with not a full-time one without a PhD. And there weren't a lot of job options. So I just started talking to people, and this was 1998, and that's when this whole movement for diversity in the workplace really started taking root. I noticed it was happening in a lot of companies, and I started talking to people who were doing the trainings. And I said, well, I have so much knowledge about religions of the world and how they operate. And I asked cultural trainers, do you talk about religion in your trainings? And they said, no, never. And they thought, in the interviews I did, they never thought that religion was really the core of an issue in the workplace. And I very much disagreed with them. So I decided to start my own business, and that's what I did. So I actually went into the field of religious diversity. I just created a little website. I started calling companies. I got one client. Then I got a second client. And I just started, you know, building up my business. And then I went to work with a company in Massachusetts who really did the whole gamut of organizational change and diversity, training and inclusion. I started working with them, and it was just a tremendous career for me for many years until I decided to then go back and do my PhD. I did want to do the PhD.
Right. Before we get to the PhD, could you give an example, without naming it necessarily, of how religious diversity issues played out in a workplace where you helped them out?
Yeah, so diversity comes, I mean, I think one of the best and easiest examples is how religious diversity plays out in healthcare environments. You have nurses and doctors and administrative staff, palliative care, for example, chaplains who are working with the whole of the population. You know, so you have Muslims and you have Jews and you have, you know, Christians and you have particular kinds of Christians, and you have Hindus and Buddhists. And how do you navigate sometimes the very different needs of the people that you see, even without stereotyping? So just the other day, for example, one of our clients shared that there was a Jewish man who told the nurse that he wanted to observe Shabbat. And she got a little bit of brain freeze, I call it, in the moment, because she said, oh, okay, but what do I do about that? And it's, you know, so we might know something about, and it's helpful for people to know something about what Jewish people will do for Shabbat. But really, a lot of my coaching is also how to talk to people and ask them what they want. So having a general base of knowledge, but then role-playing and saying, well, what are the, you know, how can I support you in that? What things might you need? And often it's as simple as that. but it makes a very big difference. Or Muslim practitioners, for example, women who really should have female practitioners working with them. But oftentimes it's not possible to have that. And how do you navigate these difficult situations where you might be short-staffed? Maybe they can have another person in the room. So we navigate situations like that in the workplace.
Or I'm thinking of an Orthodox single man who doesn't feel he should touch women. How does he navigate having women nurses touching him all over? Is that an issue?
I haven't had that one in particular, more in a Muslim context. You know, male practitioners with female patients is a very sensitive issue, and it's navigated differently. It does come up. Mm. So having a third party present, having their husband present, there are ways, if it has to be done, that you can navigate it. And if it's not possible, realizing that this will cause the patient sometimes extreme discomfort and stress is then something you can talk to them about again and say, I acknowledge that this is a modesty issue for you and a religious issue, and there's no way we can accommodate this right now. Maybe if we wait for half an hour, if it's not an emergency, you know, maybe they're willing to wait for half an hour for a female practitioner. So there are just different ways. If you open up that dialogue, that the stress doesn't need to be there, and it's assuaged in the dialogue.
Got it. Do you feel like saying the name of your company in case anybody needs that kind of service?
Sure. Well, right now, the Religious Diversity in the Workplace work that I do is with Hartford International University for Religion and Peace. So I work with them as a fellow at their university, and we do the outreach to companies. So I would say go to them.
Yeah, okay. You know, what would be really fascinating would be to go to Saudi Arabia and see how they navigate all those gender restrictions and requirements. I think that would be fascinating. I'd love to be
a
fly on the wall. Have you been to Israel?
I have.
And what did that feel like, where everybody is just about celebrates Shabbat or says Shabbat, you know, greetings? Did it feel different and embracing?
It does feel different because the dominant culture is, of course, my own. And yes, it certainly feels different. It feels different. And, you know, I love living here in the U.S., so I don't think I would move. But it's important, because I do have two kids. And it's important that they get that sense of what it's like to be in that community. So, you know, we had an amazing Hanukkah celebration here the other day, and we got to go, and it was, you know, in the public square here in Greenwich where I live, and there was the 12-foot menorah that they lit with torches, and the fire truck was there, and then just the parties while the kids got glow sticks, and they threw gelt, you know, the little foil coins off the top of the fire truck, and the kids were looking for it in the dark with their glow sticks, and they're searching, and it was just an amazing event. My daughter was singing and they were dancing, and you know, so it's important, I think, to feel a part of, like, even here it took many years for the town to allow a public celebration of Hanukkah right there on Greenwich Avenue, and it's important to feel that you're part of the community. You're not just part of your own little community, but you're really part of the larger community.
Mm-hmm. And so tell us about your dissertation topic. And you talk about mimetic desire. I have no idea what that is.
Oh, that's a can of worms. okay, so... So this idea of, well, mimesis very simply means imitation. And then there's this idea of mimetic desire. So I learned of this from a scholar named René Girard, He was an emeritus professor at Stanford University. And before that, he was at Johns Hopkins. He was a French scholar of literature, really. So he taught literary theory and also, you know, went strongly into different social sciences, too, because his theories crossed over. But so Girard detected this idea of mimesis through studying classical texts like Shakespeare and Proust and Dostoevsky. And he noticed that the characters and their relationships in those texts, as well as their kind of self-reflection, said something about their being in the world. So anyway, this will come clear in a minute. So mimesis means imitation, and mimetic desire is literally imitating the desires of others. So simply, we want what others want. There's almost nothing that we want. Well, really, Girard would say there's nothing that we want that is not a reflection of our society or what others have already. So we want things because others want them. If no one else wants them, they're not desirable.
can you think of a cross-cultural difference in desire of something that one culture does not want that another culture really wants?
What an interesting question.
I'm thinking of like dating, like in Muslim countries, India, dating is frowned upon and maybe people don't want to date. They're happy to have the families arrange the marriage, where here in the Western world, teens want to date. Does that fit?
Well, it's a cultural value, so how do we distinguish that? See, I think Girard would go underneath that even and say the people in that culture already want arranged marriage. It's built into the culture. Therefore, you need to want that too. So all the people who are brought up in that culture would automatically be told to want that. And there are some people that don't want that, and it creates a real rift, quite a large conflict. So I'm not sure that I could say that that's not mimetic. I think mimesis comes from the culture.
Yeah, that was my example of what would be mimetic. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a great, great example. So ultimately, this kind of mimesis does create conflict, because if you think about it, I always think of two children. The two children are in a room and they have a choice of toys. And one child will go for this toy, and it's inevitable that the second child will also want to play with the same toy.
Yeah.
And then you'll have a conflict. Why does the second child need that toy when maybe it's not even something they're particularly compelled to play with, you know, without the other kid there? So we want what others want, and that's, you know, from a very young age, you can see that. But it doesn't go away when we're older. It just gets hidden underneath other things. Even marketing, I always think, is very mimetic in how it operates. So if Kim Kardashian is drinking, you know, Essentia brand water, and I go to the supermarket, I see Essentia brand water, and I buy it because, oh, well, it's not just because Kim Kardashian was drinking it, it's I can be like, or I can be Kim Kardashian if I drink that water, you know?
God forbid, but yeah, I get it.
But it works on that principle, you know, that's marketing. And the closer people get, if I actually became Kim Kardashian, maybe a terrible example, but if I actually became Kim Kardashian, there becomes a rivalry the closer I get to her fame and her power and her status. So you see it in Cain and Abel in the Bible, where all of a sudden, you know, one kills the other because they can't. They're brothers. Cain will never be able to sacrifice in the way that Abel is and have it accepted by God. So he
if you're just tuning in, we're listening to Vanessa Avery talk about interreligious connections and understanding. You're listening to KCFR 90.1. And this is Gail Kimball. Tune in the second Thursday of each month, 6 to 7 p.m. Email me, gkimball@csuchico.edu, or come by at Shalom Free Clinic, Energy Balancing, every Wednesday from 6 to 7 at 10:10.
Which is really just revolutionary for
hope to see you.
People. It was revolutionary for Gerard because he went from being an atheist to being a devout Catholic after he had this insight. And he looked at the New Testament particularly.
Vanessa,
and he examined the event of the crucifixion not as a theological event, but an anthropological event
we've been
of
to
different
Vanessa
groups
Avery,
being in a kind of mimetic conflict for power. And when the power struggle happens, when this mimesis is really getting too heated, the only way to reconcile it is to create a scapegoat.
Which I am doing.
So he saw Jesus as the scapegoat of a heated mimetic rivalry
between Romans, Jews, Greeks.
I will.
There were all those groups
figure
there.
Figure out what's going
on exactly.
In a minute.
So he saw it as a scapegoating event. And then he looked at other types of literature. He looked at the Vedas of Hinduism. He looked at the Hebrew scriptures.
So your dissertation exactly was what?
So the dissertation actually applied Gerard's theory to three texts in the Hebrew Bible. So I didn't feel like they were adequately explored with a real understanding of Judaism beneath them and how the Hebrew texts operate. So I looked at a ritual of Shabbat from a text with Jacob in Genesis. I looked at the book of Esther, and then I looked at the book of Jonah. And it was important that each text had a ritual associated with it because I understood ultimately the ritual to keep mimesis in check. So I called it Jewish vaccines against mimetic desire. They're kind of like vaccines we take through doing the ritual so that we don't get into this really violent kind of rivalry in our life or conflict.
Got it.
Even if it's just emotional, obviously. But yeah.
Did that dissertation get published?
It did in different chapters. So ultimately what I chose to do was I had delivered the chapters at conferences so many times as well that I thought it was easier to publish them that way in the end. So they're all out there for public consumption.
What was it like to do graduate work in Canada and England as compared to the States?
I didn't feel much of a difference in Canada when I was up there. I mean, that was a long time ago, and I was, of course, in the bubble of a university, so I don't think I experienced what it is to really be in Canada as a citizen and work and such. But the people are, I mean, many of them are still my best friends, and they are just friendly and laid back. I'm from New York City, so I'm not particularly, so anyone might be laid back compared to me. But they were really laid back and kind people.
That's the stereotype. Canadians are nice.
They are. They really are.
That's been my experience.
Yeah.
And what about the University of Exeter?
Exeter, well, that was actually done mainly through the satellite program at Hartford International University. They used to be called Hartford Seminary. So it was a joint program. I did most of my work in Hartford. I did go to Exeter for a residency, and I did have an advisor there, and we communicated mainly through email. So Exeter, when I did my residency, I mean, it was wonderful. I think, you know, it was only a few months that I lived there. And it recalled my degree in London very much so. I love England. I love being in England. I might never have left. But it was time to come home. So
where did you meet your husband in your travels?
My husband, actually, I met him when I was about 22 in New York City. He had just graduated from Princeton, and I was staying for an extra year at McGill. So I'd finished my fourth year, but I was staying on to do some extra courses I wanted to do. We have mutual friends, and it wasn't until much later. I went through various degrees here and there, and he basically stayed in New York City, went to New Jersey for a while, but we reconnected later in life and got married.
So you thought of him at first just as friends, and something changed in the chemistry between the two of you?
No, I loved him from the moment I saw him.
I just did a book called Happy Marriages about couples with long durations of their marriage, and I'm interested in what makes a marriage stay vibrant over time. Do you have any insights in terms of your experience?
What makes a marriage last? Well, communication is certainly key, and I think communicating kindly is helpful, although it's sometimes hard. but to try, at least, and to be able to hear your partner and what they need, I think that really is the key. We support each other. We've gone through a number of life events together, and
like children or life events.
Children, death, you know, money, no money, just a lot of things, and work and good work situations and bad work situations. And I've traveled for work often. You know, I worked in St. Louis, I worked in Ohio. So we've moved a lot. So we've been through a lot, and I just think the ability to keep communicating, and while I think it's hard to change, sometimes we have to change to meet each other's needs. And as long as you can keep doing that and not losing yourself at the same time, it's very important.
Mm-hmm. What, to go back to your research, Book of Esther, why was Esther particularly interesting to you? And was she a prophet? I've forgotten her role.
Not a prophet per se. She was a queen.
Oh.
An unlikely queen, you might say. She was, you know, an orphan brought up by her uncle, Jewish in a Persian context. So this is not necessarily history. It's really like historical fiction of what it's like for the Jewish people to live in exile. But, you know, there was a call for a new queen after the first queen was, in my interpretation, scapegoated. And so she was picked as the most beautiful. And what fascinated me, I guess, was how through my understanding of Gerard and his paradigm, if you look at Esther through Gerard's theory, then you can see how there's this rivalry between, and it gets into some of the details of the story, but you can see that there is clearly a rivalry between the Jewish people and the Persian kingdom. And to the point where the Persians say, oh, we're going to exterminate the Jews. So the rivalry gets really bad, obviously. And there's, so the Jews were about to be scapegoated. And what Queen Esther does is she manages, through this kind of ritualistic process, to turn the tables such that the Jews don't get exterminated, but the one person who was responsible for sending out that edict to the kingdom to kill the Jews, he's the one who falls instead. And then the Persians and the Jews are reconciled. So it's interesting. She turns the scapegoating table from the Jews onto actually the guilty party. And usually the scapegoat is not the guilty party. So it's not a perfect fit with Gerard, and there are still, you know, a lot of questions, but I use this book because Esther's been problematic in history for both, mainly for Christians, I think, but perhaps for Jews too, because there is a lot of violence in the book. Especially, I mean, not just the edict to exterminate the Jews, but at the end, there's a lot of violence where actually a lot of the Jewish people are killed if they don't. You know, under the edict, everyone kind of had to go if they didn't agree. And it's, people wonder why the end had to be so violent. Why couldn't the edict have been done away with? Why couldn't the guilty party named Haman just, he was killed? Why couldn't that be enough? But instead they had to have this violent conflict. So that was the real question. And to reveal the answer, if anyone's interested, the very edict that couldn't be revoked, the king actually said it could not be revoked. So even though it was changed in nature, my understanding of that edict for extermination is that that is the scapegoat mechanism that rules society. So we could never actually revoke it. It has to play out.
Oh, wow.
And the interesting thing about Esther and how disturbing it is on many levels is that God never appears in the book. There are kind of, there are interpretations over history where people kind of put him in, but he literally never appears in the book. And God is not present in my theology in a scapegoating mechanism. So if Esther is the scapegoating mechanism, then it's clear to me why God is not present in it. Mm. It's just a book that to me says, this is the way of the world. And if you realize that, perhaps we can step out of it for a few moments. Mm. And that's our vaccine, is to hear the book and to hear really the message of it.
Mm. It's interesting to me that there, on one hand, the Old Testament has women as prophets.
So you've been listening
and
to
key figures
Ask Dr.
who manipulate
Gale,
behind the scenes,
an interview
the king
with
or
Vanessa
whatever,
Avery,
like Esther.
Who is
and
a
yet there's the tradition of women don't study
Yale
Torah,
Divinity.
Like Jesus had to say,
most
Mary
of my interviews
had chosen the better part to be
video,
doing
on my YouTube channel.
Theology
you
discussions
see the
with me rather than Martha in the kitchen. So how do those two traditions
so,
come together? Women as leaders,
to
prophets, women
and
should manage the household, let men study Torah. Study
no
Torah.
Idea what that is, but we will find.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, very traditionally, men have been the ones to study and read Torah aloud. It's not that way anymore. Unless you're among the ultra-Orthodox that still separate the genders.